Welcome to the Western Magazine Hour, stories and articles about the American West, produced at the Recording Library of West Texas. Your narrator is Jack.
Hello, this is Michael, and I'm reading from True West Magazine. December 1957 edition. I Spent Christmas on a Horse by Faye E. Smith. It was a tragic message the writer brought to the lonely ranch house in the blizzard-swept Lorraine Mountains, but somebody had to carry it. The wolves on my trail were getting closer. My horse was tired. His fastest gait was a slow walk. I was facing the blizzard. It was bitterly cold. Coming up the canyon, it was tough going for my pony, about a foot of snow and all uphill. It was Christmas Day in the year 1911. I was riding at that time with the Diamond Ranch Cowboys, home ranch near Bosler, Wyoming. That morning, a telegram had arrived at the tiny telegraph office on the Union Pacific Railroad, addressed to Tom Moore. Tom was a homesteader who had taken up a claim at Sabile Springs, 15 miles east, over in the Lorraine Mountains. The message stated that Tom's mother in Iowa was dead. The telegraph operator got someone to go to our ranch and ask for a rider to deliver the telegram. There were no telephones in that country then. No automobiles either. I volunteered, for the message just had to be delivered. That was hard to do, for the bunkhouse was warm and cheerful. We had a big wood pile, and nobody was too lazy to feed the fire. Our only work on Christmas Day was to fork out hay for the stock. No cows to milk. We used canned milk on a ranch with hundreds of cows. We riders wouldn't even fix a fence. There was a chore boy to do that. We had a real high-class outfit, including a saddle maker to repair saddles and harness and a blacksmith to keep our horses shod. The ranch manager had invited us to dinner in the big house, and we knew he'd pour a drink in honor of the occasion. There was a wash tub of hot water on the floor and a pot heating up on the stove, and we punchers were busy bathing, shaving, and trying to find clean shirts. Then the message arrived, and a sober pall dropped over us. I took my top horse to make the ride. He was a bronc, but as he had a bit of a hot blood, he was long-legged and handy in deep snow. I dressed warm, long woolen underwear, heavy Mackinshaw pants, flannel shirt, saddle-length fur-lined coat, and Gora fur chaps. My tailor-made boots were slick leather-lined that double leather added warmth. I had a pair of high-heeled overshoes which fitted the cowboy boots. The low flat heels some men wear now had not been invented. We wore 2-inch underslung heels, which would keep a rider's foot from going through the stirrup if a horse fell. I owned a good six-shooter, a 32-20 caliber Beisley modeled single-action Colt with a 7.5-inch barrel. In those days, we wore guns not so much for protection against men as for use on animals. A man could get into trouble with his rope when alone if he tied onto a critter that was too big and his horse was jerked down. Also, there were bears, wolves, coyotes, and rattlesnakes. But I didn't figure to have any trouble this trip, so I left the gun in the bunkhouse, that much less weight for the horse to carry. Right there, I made a bad boner. I had to first cross the Lorraine Plains for 10 miles upgrade to the pass at the western edge of the mountains. There, I would enter the canyon that led down to the Moore Ranch, a distance of about 5 miles. I made it okay. Tom Moore saw me ride up and come out to bid me welcome, for visitors were few at that lonely ranch. He told me it had been many days since they had seen another human being, and now it had to be on Christmas Day with a sad message like mine. In those times, every ranch was a place to eat and rest, whether the traveler be friend or stranger. Tom invited me in to eat the best Christmas dinner I ever had, for I was plenty hungry and cold. First, he stabled my horse at a manger full of hay. then took me inside the house to meet the family and sit down at table with them. We had deer meat, potatoes, gravy, and hot biscuits. Tom's few cattle were too valuable to be butchered for personal use, so Tom got meat for the table with his rifle: elk, deer, antelope, sage, chickens, and rabbits. He had no money with which to buy a turkey, no place to buy one anyhow. Even the ranchers with money bought groceries only twice a year, spring and fall, if the ranches were in the isolated backcountry, as many were. For some ranchers, it was a trip of several days with a 2 or 4 horse team and wagon. Tom was too broke to go to the funeral, but he wrote his answer to the telegram after dinner and silently handed it to me. I started back at once, as I was worried about being caught on those plains in the storm after dark. My horse plodded slowly up the canyon, head on into the storm. We had gone but a mile or so when I noticed he was getting jumpy and uneasy. This shouldn't have happened to a tired mount bucking a blizzard. I looked back to see 2 big gray lobo wolves on our trail. These were ugly devils, sometimes called buffalo wolves, as they stand higher at the shoulders than at the hindquarters. From then on, I rode with my chin over my shoulder, waiting for them to make a move. There was nothing I could do. I dared not urge my horse to a faster gait. Too many tough miles remained ahead, and he might play out entirely if I pushed him. Anyhow, the wolves could have kept up with us easily, even if I had spooked and went to quarting my horse. So I just plugged along, with the wolves getting bolder and closer. Apparently by this time, they had figured out that I had no gun and was harmless. Today, 46 years later, I still wonder how a wolf can tell when a man or an animal is weak and near exhaustion. When we reached the wire gate at the head of the canyon and the edge of the plains, we were really in trouble. The wolves were now only a few feet behind me. So close, I was afraid to get off my horse to open the gate. Now, I thought desperately, if only I had another rider with me and we had fresh horses, we could rope them both. $25 apiece bounty for wolves, and we cowboys could use that kind of dough. Crazy thinking in a spot like mine. But the thought gave me an idea. A lariat rope is always a good weapon, and mine was on the saddle as always. I took it off, spilled the loop out of the end. I didn't want to catch one of them, and turned my horse to face them. Yelling like a Comanche on the warpath, I dismounted and threw the end of my rope at the ornery critters. The wolves crouched and snarled, then whirled and took off. A short distance only, but they retreated. Still hollering and waving the rope, I got the gate open, led my horse through, closed the gate. We don't leave gates open in my country. Mounted and rode off. I guess the wolves figured out the pair of us weren't as weak as we appeared to be, for they didn't come through the fence after us. But our troubles were not over. The storm had a 100-mile sweep across the Lorraine Plains, and we had to face it. Our dim trail was soon lost in the deep snow. 10 miles to go, with visibility zero. That phrase hadn't been coined in 1911. When a rider is lost, a good horse will generally take him home if given his head. However, horses don't like to face a storm, and I wasn't sure whether mine would or not. I figured it was safer and smarter to keep him facing the wind. This is good policy only if the wind doesn't change direction, but I had to take that chance. I did some fast calculating. The Laramie River crosses this desolate stretch of plains, and the ranch was on the river. So if I could hit the river, all I would have to figure was whether I was up or downstream from the ranch. A hell of a gamble, but at least I'd have a 50-50 chance of being right. Somehow the odds didn't seem so good when my life was at stake. My horse's eyelids froze shut, and ice formed in his nostrils. Feeling sorry for the poor cuss, I got off and wiped his eyes and nose. I felt sorry for me, too. I had the same trouble. The horse was more important. I knew that without him, I'd never leave these blizzard-swept plains alive. Maybe neither of us would get out alive, but I tried not to think about that. Darkness fell, but we were still headed into the wind. No way of telling how far we had come, nor how far we had to go, nor even if we were going in the right direction. It was the doggonest lonesome feeling to know that somewhere off in the howling dark, your buddies were sitting in a warm bunkhouse and wondering if you were ever going to show up alive. I quit thinking that way, but then I got to thinking about Portuguese Phillips and the long winter ride he made from Fort Phil Kearny to Fort Loramie in 1866. Phillips's horse collapsed and died when he reached Loramie. I wondered if mine could keep going. He did, and we hit the river. I couldn't tell whether we were upstream or downstream from the ranch, so I decided to let the horse figure it out. I got off, held a loose rein, though I was chilled to the bone and the horse about to quit. Walking will warm me up a mite, and the weight off will help the horse, I thought duly to myself as I plodded along. It was the right hunch. That good horse led me right to the ranch about a half mile away. The boys whooped when they saw me, stripped off my icy clothes, and hustled me into my bunk. And just like Portuguese Phillips had said in 1866, I mumbled, "Never mind me, take care of my horse." A fiction story would end here at the dramatic high point, but this is truth, so there's more to tell. I'd seen that Tom Moore was having it tough out there in that wild country. More especially, his wife and kids were having it tough, for Tom could take it even though his boots had a gaping hole in the side and he was walking practically barefoot in the snow. I think the Moores had purposely failed to tell the children that it was Christmas, for there was no way they could observe it. Those kids had but one toy, a ball that Mrs. Moore had sewed out of rags. When I told the boys the story, they passed the hat and collected a right substantial stake. We went to town and bought those kids a whole bag full of toys for a belated Merry Christmas. I had the privilege of delivering the toys. I told the kids old Santa Claus had been delayed by the blizzard. You never saw such surprise and joy on kids' faces in your life. I never enjoyed a Christmas as much as that one. Made a man misty-eyed just to watch those happy kids whoop it up. Tom's little herd grew and multiplied. The last I heard of him, he had a modern home, an automobile, and had put the kids through college. And like so many Westerners, he did it all with his own two hands and the help of a loyal, loving, hard-working wife and family. True West Magazine, December 1957 edition. Christmas in a Canyon by J.C. Tolman. A fascinating Yuletide glimpse of the Old West of long ago. Editor's note. Surveyors have been in the van of every American frontier, but relatively few of them have left written records of their work and way of life other than field notes. The following vivid account of the experiences of a surveying party on the Texas Plains in 1887 is taken at the suggestion of Dr. Walter Prescott Webb from the Texaco Star, December 1925, with the permission of the Texas Company. Said Watt, "Bill and I done gathered all the buffalo chips often four sections around this here camp, and I ain't going no further. If you can't make out cook two meals with this here quart of 'em, I guess we all go hungry." "Oomph," said Bill. "Yeah," remarked Watt. "I know this here gall darn drizzle drazzle done made the sap rise in the chips, and it's hard to get a heat on these ovens, but it's 40 miles to the nearest brush, and God knows how far to a tree, and my back is done give out totin' chips. Bosh, said Bill, as he lifted the top of a Dutch oven to take a look at the biscuits in which he took so much pride. They were always light and delectable when he could get the proper heat on his ovens. Lordy, Bill, exclaimed Watt, I never seen you make such biscuits. Them looks to me as though they had squat to rise and baked on the squat. Bill threw a poker at him, which he neatly dodged, and it nearly hit Bill's pet wildcat. Kitty spat irritably and lit on the top of the chuck wagon, his perch in time of trouble. Presently, Watt said, I hear the line wagon about a mile off, coming fast. Presently, Dave and Martin rode up, unsaddled, and fed their ponies. By that time, the line wagon reached camp, and both of the chainmen helped Seeb unharness and feed. Presently, the major ambled up on Old Sideways, the hip shot cayuse provided by a rich corporation for this particular topographer. The surveying party was complete and hungry as usual. Bill pounded a 3-foot iron rope with a poker, and 8 members of a pioneer surveying party gathered around a table made of 2 boards and situated near the northwest corner of block number 7, IGNRR Company Survey, in the panhandle of Texas, the time being late in the year 1887. That was only 70 years ago, just the allotted biblical span of a man's life, a brief flicker of time hardly to be considered in the life of a nation. But consider, in 1887, between No Man's Land on the north, the Palo Duro on the south, the Indian Territory on the east, and New Mexico on the west, there were just 36 houses outside the town of Mobiti Fort Elliott and a little settlement at Tascosa. Mobiti was the metropolis of the area and boasted a population of 350 humans. There was no railroad, no graded road, no fence, except small pastures near headquarter ranch houses. In the breaks and canyons, one could find objects by which to guide oneself. But on the Llano Estacado, there was only a grass-covered plain extending beyond the range of sight. This plain had been the home of the buffalo, and their bones, skulls, and horns could be seen in any direction. Within the next few years, the bone hunters were to gather these and haul them many miles to be shipped by rail and made into fertilizer. The buffalo chip, or dried dung, was the only fuel of the plains as long as it could be found. At the time of this sketch, there were thousands of antelope and many hundreds of mustangs on the plains. Prince Charlie, Goodnight, had preserved a few buffalo on the J.A. Ranch on the lower Palo Duro, and few wild herds were reported on the North Plains, but all the rest of the mighty bison herds were dead. It would have been so very easy to have preserved some of them. Also, our trees and birds and... But we are democratic, and so... At night, the men slept on the blanket rolls on the ground. There is no finer bed for the tired outdoor man. Tents were pitched whenever the weather was unpleasant, but most of the time, sleep was in the open. It was a hard but healthy life. The drizzle ceased sometime in the night, and Bill had breakfast ready by daylight. He pounded on his iron pipe with his accursed poker and yelled his matin song in a hideous voice. Wake up, snakes! Day's a-breakin'! Blessed sleep. Blessings brighten as they take their flight. For many years, one of that outfit has thought that old Bill might have developed a gentler method by which to dispel slumber. Well, anyhow, the outfit ceased to sleep and presently was washed and grubbed, and the stock was fed and watered and saddled or hitched. The surveying outfit loaded in the light line wagon and the tents and bedrolls piled near the camp wagons so that the camp rustler could load them with the least trouble. Then the line party started for the point where they had quit work the night before. This was a small mound of sod and was visible for 3 miles. They reached it betimes, and PG, the chief, had his transit set and took his first sight almost before the refraction of the sun's early rays ceased to interfere. Dave, the front flagman, could lope his pony a half mile and take a sight and not miss the distance more than a few feet. PG had Seeb drive him up to the hub and dig up a chunk of sod to mark the spot. By that time, PG would be ready for a back sight on Martin's flag, and Dave would be ready a half mile ahead. PG would set Dave and proceed. Martin would lope gaily up to the piece of sod, which could be seen half a mile, and find his tack point in time for another sight. It was lovely and easy for everybody. That is to say, everybody who had an easy job. The chain carriers, of course, had to walk every foot of the line and measure it carefully. If one of them made an error, things would blow up. Somehow, the poor devils averaged over 7 miles of measured line for each and every day for 7 years and didn't seem to make any appreciable error. Of course, they were dull creatures, not temperamental, nor given to flights of fancy. Lines were run and marked to the north as far as the head of McClellan Creek. From a corner of this line, another line was traced to the west, and corners established on the area where the town of Amarillo was afterwards started. Lines were run to the east as far to the line of the J.A. Ranch. These lines were over the plains. As far as the eye could see, the corners of the sections and blocks could be observed when the atmosphere was not disturbed. Frequently, the mirage played strange tricks on the Llano Estacado. One day, near the head of North Fork, we suddenly saw Al Holland driving Beck and Sue, a team of mules, apparently about a half mile away. We thought he would reach us in a few minutes, but they jogged along for half an hour and then faded away. Afterwards, it was found that at the time he was nearly 20 miles away. A few days later, PG took the outfit to the west line of the X range to meet Mr. Gray, who was to show some corners. When we arrived at the rendezvous, we saw the two black ponies he drove trotting along with his white canvas-topped buckboard, which we easily recognized. We waited an hour, and he seemed no nearer, so we drove to meet him. At about a mile from the rendezvous, his outfit was suddenly changed into a white buffalo skull with two black horns. While we stared at it, Mr. Gray suddenly appeared from nowhere in another direction and reached us in a few minutes. One day, we started to run a line south. It was a clear, still day, and it seemed that visibility was infinite. We could see cattle ahead for miles. And there were several herds of antelope and mustangs in sight. The major, mounted on Old Sideways, was ambling on ahead. A topographer had mighty little to map on the plains. He drew a square for a section and lettered LP neatly in a corner. Suddenly, the major and Old Sideways began to sink beneath the surface. We yelled, and he turned and waved his hat as though cheering on his men at Kennesaw Mountain fight. Then he disappeared beneath the plain. The cattle, antelope, and mustangs were in plain view for miles ahead, beyond where he disappeared. A calm buzzard floated on motionless wings about a mile above us. We wondered if that meant anything. They are wise birds. Dave loped ahead, started to sink, stopped, and called for a point at short range. We hurried on, reached and passed Dave, started down a gentle slope, and stopped on the brink of the Palo Duro Canyon. To see the sight in front of us was enough to make the heart miss a beat. It could not be looked upon without causing the beholder to thrill with appreciation of the wonderful works of the great architect of the universe. Here, the result of the slow erosive actions of waters through hundreds of thousands, perhaps millions of years, was a gash cut through the plains for 50 miles. In places, it is over 1,000 feet deep and 5 miles in width. It is one of the wonder spots of America. Along the rim, we saw a band of yellow where the plains grass dipped to the rim rock. This rim rock, a heavy band of gray, capped the canyon as far as the eye could reach. Below it, the exposed strata showed as though some giant hand had drawn brushes, dipped in many colors along the miles of canyon walls. Pink, blue, red, gray, green, yellow, purple, brown, blended in the distance into a lovely purple shade. At intervals were ledges clothed with the deep green of tall cedars. Diamond-like points of light were reflected from springs gushing out of the rocks to fall in terraced cascades and to be lost in the sand and gravel at the bottom of the gorge. We gazed in silence for a long, long time. The air was like crystal in the canyon that crisp winter day. Movements along a great cedar-covered ledge, a half mile across the gash and 500 feet down, caught Dave's huntsman's eyes. He pointed. "Look," he almost whispered. "Two bears, and over there, turkeys, more than 20. The major sat on a rock, feverishly doing topography. He had plenty to do. He was happy with the slopes of all degrees and directions, with precipices here and there. To the south, mustangs, antelope, and cattle contentedly grazed. We camped where we found some rainwater caught in large potholes in the cap rock. Next day, it took Dave half a day of hard climbing to reach the south side of the canyon, where he established line points where we triangulated. We could not hope to measure accurately across that gorge. The wagons had to go to the junction of the Palo Duro and Terra Blanca canyons to effect a crossing to the south side. We ran many survey lines over the plains and in the canyons. Much of the work was by triangulation and was very interesting indeed. We camped one Saturday night at a waterhole on a nameless creek which ran into the Palo Duro. Sunday morning, all the men were in the tents, resting, when PG went outside and at once called in an awestruck voice, "Great Caesar's ghost! Boys, look here!" The wonder-working mirage was busy. The Palo Duro lay extended beneath us, and up in the heavens was another Palo Duro Canyon, upside down. Every stratum of rock, every clump of trees, the gleaming surfaces of water, all to the minutest detail, were plainly to be seen reversed in the sky above. The phenomenon lasted for nearly an hour. Seldom is such a wonderful sight beheld by man. PG named the creek near our camp Sunday Creek. It is on the map now. The work on the south side was completed, and we moved back to the north side of the canyon and worked until the latter part of December. There had been no very severe weather, rather warm days and cool, delightful nights. The air was like fine wine. Work was a vast delight. Sleep under the stars was a dip into the fountain of perpetual youth. One of the wagons had gone to town for supplies and returned 2 days before Christmas. On the morning of the 24th, we broke camp and the heavy wagons started for a new campsite several miles to the east of where our first line had crossed the canyon. The line crew went several miles to the north and started to run a line south toward the new camp. All went well until about the middle of the afternoon. Dave had just taken a front sight and given the okay signal to come ahead when we saw him wave his arms in a signal that meant look. He seemed to point to the north. We looked, but could see nothing unusual. When we reached Dave and asked what was the matter, he answered, "Norther coming," and loped off for another sight. There did seem to be a slight haze in the north, low down on the surface of the plains. When we reached the next hub and looked back, there was a dun-colored arch distinct above the plain, far to the north. At the next stop, we established a corner and dug four pits and built an earth mound. I remember we were quite warm from the work. By the time we were through this, hardly three quarters of an hour from the time Dave's sharp eyes had seen the approaching norther, the dun-colored arch extended to the horizon from east to west and was almost upon us from the north. It did not extend very far above the plains. PG gave the order to quit work and make for camp. The outfit moved with celerity. The major and old sideways had gone south some time before. Dave and Martin let their ponies lope. Seeb shook the reins at his long-legged light wagon team, and they galloped madly from the storm. But it caught us in a few minutes. With a rush of ice-cold wind, a snarl like an angry beast, an awful roar, changing into a long, drawn-out wail, which continued to rise and fall. The yellow norther of the plains struck and enveloped us. The air was full of ice needles that drove into the exposed flesh and stuck, but did not seem to melt. The snow seemed to parallel the ground in its flight. Yet the plains grass was covered by it in a few minutes, and it rolled along the ground with the wind. That wind didn't turn aside. When it hit you, it just kept right on through your body, as though your flesh offered no obstruction to it. There wasn't a hill between us and the North Pole, and that wind must have come all the way, and gathering power at every jump. We had been sweating 10 minutes before. Now we pulled the wagon sheet over us, huddling under it, but the wind and cold were pitiless and cut and stung, despite the cover. Seeb let his mules run for several miles. They ran straight south and made no effort to turn. The norther attended to that. We couldn't see 10 feet ahead of the team, but we knew that somewhere ahead of us was a 1,000-foot canyon with sides nearly straight down for several hundred feet. We knew we had gone a long way, and we thought we were within a mile of the cap rock when those two Missouri mules suddenly stopped. Fortunately, nothing broke, and we managed to stay in the wagon. C pulled to the left and urged the team. They didn't want to turn sideways to the wind and sleet, but C managed to make them move. Almost immediately, we started downgrade, and in less than half a minute, we were below the plains level. Seeb turned the team to the right, and we scrambled down onto a bench, high above the bottom of the canyon, but 200 feet below the top of a precipice of solid rock. The wind roared far above us, but there was no gust that reached to our level. The snow fell in sheets about us, but dropped calmly straight down. And there, by our good luck, was the camp. The teamsters had pitched the tents, a courtesy extended only in times of stress, and old Bill had a fire going, and supper was well on the way. After we had thawed out and moved around a bit, one of the boys noticed a cleft in the face of the precipice about 30 feet above its base, and in the cleft were three or four dead cedars. He threw a blazing piece of wood into the dry limbs, and it hung there and set fire to one of the trees. In a short time, we had a roaring torch 50 or 60 feet tall. We ate supper by its light, and shortly thereafter, the trees burnt off from the stumps, and a wonderful avalanche of flaming wood and coals piled itself at the base of the rock. It burnt for hours and warmed quite a large space around the camp. When we had finished First Smoke, PG announced that he had a new novel by The Duchess and would read to us. We helped old Bill wash the dishes so that we could hear the story, he being naturally romantic and a great admirer of The Duchess. The light from the great fire was sufficient, and we gathered around PG and listened as he read of real high-toned society folk, even an occasional nobleman and titled lady, who entered the scenes with perfect grace and beauty, and who made love in a most delicate and refined way. It was all so different from what we knew. Late at night, while PG was reading a very tender passage, he was interrupted by a maniacal chorus of shrieks and howls, deep-throated, menacing, and terrifying. The reading ceased until the pack had yelled their way a long distance from our sheltering bank over the snow-covered plain. The Lobo wolves were hungry and were hunting. Again, PG's voice took us back to the tenderness and beauty of the Irish land, and we thrilled with the hero and laughed with the Dickie Brown. The light from the fire died down, but the glowing coals still melted the snow around us. Old Bill lit a lantern and placed it on a tomato box by PG's shoulder. The Duchess was no mean writer, and her description of garden fates, picnics, balls, and lovemaking gripped and held us. We were all young, in years at least, and each one saw himself the hero of the tale, and each made the delicate remarks at the proper time, and at the end, each of us thrilled to the kiss of promise of the lovely heroine. PG finished the tale, and we sat a while in blissful silence. Then Dave murmured, "That's a humdinger of a love story." "Let's go to Ireland on a cattle boat," suggested Martin. "Sure, let's." PG looked at his watch. "Good gracious, it's past 1 o'clock. Merry Christmas." We shook hands all around. Old Bill sighed deeply. "It sure started fine, Chief. I looked at my watch just at 12, and that cuss was putting his arm around that lady for the first time, and it was a Christmas Eve, and she wished him Merry Christmas. Doggone the luck. Good night." Here's a story from True West magazine. This issue is simply dated Winter 1953. Montana, A Savage Santa Claus, by Charles M. Russell. Santa Claus came to see Bedrock and Beaver all right, but when he arrived, they just as soon he hadn't come. "Talking about Christmas," said Bedrock as we smoked in his cabin after supper, and the wind howled as it sometimes can on a blizzardy December night. "Puts me in the mind of one I spent in the 60s. Me and a feller named Jake Mason, but better known as Beaver, is trapping and prospecting on the head of the Porcupine. We've struck some placer, but she's too cold to work her. The snows drove all the game out of the country, and barring a few beans and some flour, we're plumb out of grub. So we decide we'd better pull our freight before we're snowed in. The winter's been pretty open till then, but the day we start, a storm breaks loose that skins everything I ever seed. It looks like a snowmaker's been holding back and turned the whole winter supply loose at once. Cold? Well, it would make a polar bear hunt over. About noon, it lets up enough so we can see our pack horses. We're jogging along at a good gait when old Baldy, our lead pack hoss, stops and swings round in the trail, bringing the other three to a stand. His winner caused me to raise my head, and looking under my hat brim, I'm plenty surprised to see an old log shack not 10 feet to the side of the trail. I guess we'd better take that cayuse's advice, says Beaver, panting to Baldy, who's got his ears straightened, looking at us as much to say, what am I packing for pilgrims? Or don't you know enough to get in out of the weather? It looks like you'd loosen these packs. So taking Baldy's hunch, we unsaddle. This cabin's mighty ancient. It's been two rooms, but the ridge pole on the rear one's rotted and let the roof down. The door's wide open and hangs on a wooden hinge. The animal smell I get on the inside tells me there ain't no humans lived there for many's the winter. The floor's strewn with pine cones and a few scattered bones, showing it's been the home of mountain rats and squirrels. Taking it all in and all, it ain't no palace, but in this storm, it looks mighty snug, and when we get a blaze started in the fireplace and the beans going, it's comfortable. The door to the back's open, and by light of the fire, I can see the roof hanging down V-shaped, leaving quite a little space agin the wall. Once I had a notion of walking in and prospecting the place, but there's something ghostly about it, and I changed my mind. When we're rolling in that night, Beaver asks me what day of the month it is. If I'm right on my dates, says I, this is the evening the kids hang up their socks. The hell it is, says he. Well, here's one camp Sandy'll probably overlook. We ain't got no socks, nor no place to hang 'em, and I don't think the old boys savvy our foot rags. That's the last I remember till I'm waked up along in the night by something monkeying with the kettle. If it weren't for a snuffing noise, I could hear a took for a trade rack, but with this noise, it's no guess with me, and I call the turn all right, 'cause when I take a peek, there, humped between me and the fire, is the most robust silver tip I ever see. In size, he resembles a load of hay. The fire's down low, but there's enough light to give me his outline. He's humped over, busy with the beans, sniffing and whining, pleasant-like. He enjoys 'em. I nudge Beaver easy and whispers, Santa Claus is here. He don't need but one look. Yes, says he, reaching for his Henry, but he ain't brought nothing but trouble, and more a sock full of that. You couldn't crowd it into a wagon box. This whispering disturbs Mr. Bear, and he straightens up till he near touches the ridge pole. He looks 8 feet tall. Am I scared? Well, I'd tell a man. By the feeling running up and down my back, if I had bristles, I'd resemble a wild hog. The cold sweat's dripping off my nose, and I ain't got nothing on me but slush ice. The bark of Beaver's Henry brings me out of the scare. The bear goes over, upsetting a kettle of water, putting the fire out. If it wasn't for a stream of fire running from Beaver's weapon, we'd be in plumb darkness. The bear's up again, bellerin' and bawlin', and comin' at us mighty warlike. And by the time I get my sharps workin', I'm near choked with smoke. It's the noisiest muss I was ever mixed up in. Between the smoke, the barkin' of the guns, and the hollerin' of the bear, it's like hell on a holiday. I'm groping for another cartridge when I hear the lock on Beaver's gun click, and I know his magazine's dry. Lowering my hot gun, I listen. Everything's quiet now. In the sudden stillness, I hear the dripping of blood. It's the bear's life running out. I guess it's all over, says Beaver, kinda shaky. It was a short fight, but a fast one, and hell was popping while she lasted. When we get the fire lit, we take a look at the battleground. There lays Mr. Bear in a ring of blood, with a hide so full of holes he wouldn't hold hay. I don't think there's a bullet went round him. This excitement wakes us so we don't sleep no more that night. We breakfast on bear meat. He's an old bear, and it's pretty stout, but a feller living on beans and bannocks straight for a couple of weeks don't kick much on flavor, and we're at a stage where meat's meat. When it comes day, me and Beaver goes looking over the bear's bedroom. You know, daylight drives away haunts, and this room don't look near so ghostly as it did last night. After winning this fight, we're both pretty brave. The roof caved in 4 or 5 feet of snow, makes the rear room still dark, so lighting a pitch pine glow, we start exploring. The first thing we bump into is the bear's bunk. There's a rusty pick laying up against the wall and a gold pan on the floor showing us the human that lived there was a miner. On the other side of the shack, we ran onto a pole bunk with a weather-wrinkled buffalo robe and some rotten blankets. The way the roof slants, we can't see into the bed, but using a pickaxe and chopping the legs off, we lower it to view. When Beaver raises the light, there's the framework of a man. He's laying on his left side like he's sleeping and looks like he's cashed in easy. Across the bunk, under his head, is an old-fashioned cap-and-ball rifle. On the bedpost hangs a powder horn and pouch with a belt and skinning knife. These things tell us this man's a pretty old-timer. Finding the pick and gold pan causes us to look more careful for what he'd been digging. We explore the bunk from the top to bottom, but nary a find. All day long we prospects. That evening, when we're filling up on bear meat, beans, and bannocks, Beaver says he's going to go through the bear's bunk. So after we smoke, relighting our torches, we start our search again. Sizing up the bear's nest, we see he had laid there quite a while. It looks like Mr. Silvertip, when the weather gets cold, starts hunting a winter location for his long snooze. Running onto this cabin, vacant and looking like it's for rent, he jumps the claim and would have been snoozing there yet, but for our fire warming up the place fools him. He thinks it's spring and steps out to look at the weather. On the way, he strikes this breakfast of beans and they hold him till we object. We're looking over this nest when something catches my eye on the edge of the waller. It's a hole roofed over with willers. "Well, I'll be damned. There's his cash," says Beaver, whose eyes has followed mine. It don't take a minute to kick these willers loose, and there lays a buckskin sack with $500 in dust in it. "Old Santa Claus out there," says Beaver, pointing to the bear through the door. "Didn't load our socks, but he brought plenty of meat and showed us the cash, for we'd never have found it if he hadn't raised the lid." The day after Christmas, we buried the bones, wrapped in one of our blankets, where we had found the cash. It was the best we could do. "I guess the dust's ours," says Beaver. "There's no papers to show who is kinfolks, so we splits the pile and leaves him sleeping in the tomb he had built for himself." From Trails Plowed Under by Charles M. Russell, copyright 1927, Doubleday, Page & Company. Here's a short article from True West, November-December 2009 edition. Uncle Chick, Me, and the Christmas Tree by Jeb Rosebrook. The aging Chevrolet carry-all van turned off the old Black Canyon Highway at Poland Junction between Mayer and Humboldt, Arizona, and began to follow the narrow, winding, muddy road up to the snowy Bradshaw Mountains. Charles Henry Ormey, a powerfully built man nearing 53, was driving. A small passenger bounced around in the front seat beside him. The year was 1945, and I was 10 years old. It was the first Christmas I had ever been away from my family. The man I would always know as Uncle Chick was taking me with him on a very special trip to bring back a Christmas tree. I was an asthmatic and had been sent west on doctor's orders with my mother from our family home outside of Stamford, Connecticut. Late at night, as the Santa Fe Chief pulled into the Ash Fork rail station, my mother and I saw the silhouette of a tall man wearing a cowboy hat. He was Mr. Ormy to me that night, and later, Uncle Chick. With his wife, Aunt Minna, he founded the Quarter Circle V-Bar Ranch School in 1929. A small group of boys and girls came not only to attend the school, but to share in the responsibilities of the working ranch as well. When I first arrived that February, fresh from the fourth grade, there were 10 of us. We were taught by one teacher in an adobe schoolhouse. Like my fellow students, I learned to feed chickens and helped out in the roundups and branding. Now I was part of the real West. I did not have to visit the doctor for shots. I did not wheeze. I could breathe. I did miss my parents. The following September, I returned as a fifth grader. By November, I learned I would not see my parents until June, as they could not come west to be with me at Christmas. An aunt in California had asked me to stay with her. She promised a visit to Republic Studios and the opportunity to meet my hero, Gene Autry. But even with all of my classmates gone home for the holidays, I wanted to be with Aunt Minna and Uncle Chick. On that December day, I accepted Uncle Chick's invitation to join him on the search for a Christmas tree. Soon enough, the narrow road gave way from mud to snow. At a place where he could turn around, Uncle Chick parked the carryall. We got out, looking at the thickly growing pines in every direction. The sun had gone behind the clouds. The sky turned gray. It was very cold. Uncle Chick carried the axe, and we cut through the snow in search of a tree. I cannot recall how far we walked, nor did I wonder whether years before he had taken his own children into these mountains to bring home a tree, or if perhaps this day he had wanted company of one so young, so believing in Christmas and the excitement of a tree. What I do remember was that I was pleased he chose me to accompany him. Just the two of us, rubber boots crunching into snow, until, high on a hillside, he found the tree of his choice. I heard no wind, just the sound of his axe working into that pine, an echo across the Bradshaws I shall never forget. The ride back to the ranch was freezing and windy because the back end of the carryall was open to accommodate the full length and growth of that magnificent tree. Christmas Day came clear and cold. Uncle Chick and Aunt Minna were joined by their daughter Catherine, a student at Stanford, and their oldest son, Charles Jr., and his bride of 7 months, Muriel. Middle son Mort was away in the Pacific in the Marine Corps. And then there was me. I spoke with my folks by telephone, received wonderful gifts from them, including a chemistry set and a Gene Autry guitar. The sound of their voices so far away made me miss them terribly. Yet the most wonderful gift of all was the tree standing in a prominent corner of the main house. I may have been a long way from home, but I had gone into the mountains and the snow and had been part of one man's life on the day he went to find the family Christmas tree. On that Christmas day, 1945, I became a part of his family, as I would be for years to come. Postscript. Charles H. Ormy Sr. would go on to serve 16 years representing Yavapai County as a state senator. Aunt Minna was elected into the Arizona Women's Hall of Fame in 1989. Their son, Charles Jr., served for more than 40 years as headmaster of what would become the Ormy School, one of the country's leading college preparatory boarding schools. The Adobe Schoolhouse is still used by students.
Thank you for joining us for the Western Magazine Hour, stories and articles about the American West. Your narrator has been Jack. You can hear this program on Recording Library of West Texas Radio and on demand with your computer or favorite mobile device at recordinglibrary.org.